Welcome, listeners, wherever you are. You're listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio 95.9 FM. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Today we have a double feature for you from fall 2020 amidst the beginning of the quarantine. These episodes tie in nicely with possible explanation of UFOs and other things paranormal. The first episode is titled Betwixt and Between. It was produced by Ken Lane on September 18th, 2020.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. Our beloved desert, in our continuing year of calamity. When the weather's good, when the skies are blue, whether clear or busy with storm clouds, when the landscape opens up, well, then I tend to do my dreaming outside, you know what I mean? Away from the chatter and the ugly things built by real estate developers. I guess then I can think straight. Because, like, those beach chair cushions at the Ace Hotel down in Palm Springs say, no bad vibes. But when it's ugly out, when our lungs hurt from the smoke, when our eyes burn, when the mountain rising up just a mile ahead looks like it's at the bottom of a jar of Vaseline, well, then the landscape cannot do its work. The birds are quiet and the human mind becomes numb. But we have another reality that we carry with us from day to day, night to night. We don't always use it in our waking life, but it's there, it's ready when we need it, ready to inspire, and ready to clean out the cobwebs. I woke from a beautiful dream the other day. The other morning, Wednesday, in fact, Woden's Day. It was one of those easy-paced dreams where nothing bizarre happens. Nothing within to suggest it's a dream while you're living it. And only in the daylight retrospection do you recall the dreamscapes. Recall how and where it differs from the waking life. But while you are there, it's as real as anything. And so for what seemed like hours on a pleasant evening in San Francisco, I wandered around a few neighborhoods that I've long loved. Although they were, in retrospect, arranged in a way so that one entered on a pedestrian street down a narrow walkway from the busier city beyond and into a lively neighborhood scene of bars and restaurants and street vendors that gracefully transition to the next neighborhood. The Mission to the Castro, Market to Cow Hollow, etc. But it was mostly the Mission District. The buildings were old, mostly of brick. The lighting was soft or spilling out from the open taverns. I had not been there for a while, it seemed. Over the course of this evening, I ran into many friends, a feast of friends, you could say. Some, like my longtime comrade Ben Sullivan, I've known for many decades. Lately, I've been exchanging some letters with Ben after a long lull, so he was on my mind, I guess. And others, like the writer Anna Merlin, a regular guest on this program, and someone I mostly know in person from randomly seeing at parties. I'd heard that her dear uncle had passed on, so she was on my mind that night. I mean, who knows why people show up when they do in your dreams. Sometimes they're just out wandering at the same time you are. Sometimes there's a message, a puzzle you can't entirely know, not right away at least. Everybody was out and about on this fine evening. There was no pandemic in this realm, although it took place in the now. There were no masks, there were no closed down nightclubs, no righteous marching down the streets, and no cops, not a one. Seeing a cop would have soured the mood, changed the tone, but the mood was good, seemingly for everyone around. There were no automobiles. None that I noticed, anyway. The streets were for people. Something I bet a lot of us are remembering from dreams these days is proximity to other human beings. Physical closeness with people, being amongst the crowd, packing too many people into a booth in the back of the bar. Far enough away from the jukebox so you can talk, but close enough that you've got to talk a little louder. Though when you drift into a party and you hug everybody you know and some you've just met. Arms draped around your old friends, passing around the pipe or tasting each other's dinners. It's a San Francisco I visit sometimes in dreams, although I don't recall a night so relaxed and sociable in that other city, the one I felt so comfortable wandering around the other night. For several hours, that comprised maybe 60 minutes of sleep between when I woke up to close the blinds at dawn and when my alarm went off an hour later, betwixt and between. One of my favorite parts of this city, this walkable and friendly city where nobody is homeless, nobody is suffering, is the streetcar system, which has only a passing resemblance to the real streetcars and cable cars. For one thing, a number of old streetcars are used as open-air shops parked on bits of sidetrack along the sidewalks. My favorite is a long newsstand completely within an old New Orleans-style streetcar, but with standing platforms like the California cable cars, most of it open to the great inventory of newspapers, magazines, paperback books, cigarettes and candy, etc. I have spent hours browsing these inventories in this other reality. The city itself is beautifully green. Trees and flowers and shrubbery everywhere. The sky blue, the fog picturesque when it appears. I've wondered why this is the city in my dreams. Of course, it incorporates architecture and other various features from other towns I've called home. But the city is never New Orleans or Washington, D.C. or Prague or Budapest or Paris or Brooklyn or Los Angeles or any of the couple dozen places I've called home for a few weeks or a few years. Maybe it's because I've never owned an automobile or even had access to one during various stints in the city named for St. Francis, the saint of nature and humanity. I rarely had money for a taxi cab or change for the bus, and so I walked miles and miles, would gladly walk several miles to meet somebody for a drink, then miles back to a party, and miles to a club, and miles home again, most of the time. One boozy night with a couple of guys I lived with in a big old Victorian in the Lower Haight, I walked from North Beach to Pacific Heights, Japantown to the Fillmore, for no reason at all, just walking and talking, stopping in for a drink here and there, a beautiful night out, a weekday evening in the wintertime. I remember the great swarms of wharf rats. Separated and scattered as we walked along the darkened docks, like swallows tumbling through the sky in springtime. A better world is possible. My friend Patrick Donnelly closed an email reply to me with those words the other day. And a few days later, some gangsters destroyed nearly half of the remaining rare desert buckwheat species he's been working to protect from extinction. Like I've told Patrick before, that better world needs boots on the ground, as they say. What else are you gonna do with your life now? Isn't it time to make a stand? And wouldn't life be sweet again if you were doing this sacred work with a handful of people committed to the same moral path? Whether for a year or for a lifetime. The world can feel a little heavy these days, a little heavier than usual, and for those of us paying attention, it has been heavy for a while now. We're no fools. We aren't hoodwinked by this back-to-normal nonsense. We know the score. We're no simps. But it's real heavy right now. It's a weighted blanket, and it's not comforting. Although it can be inspiring when we know what to look for. When we know that your nutty neighbor or your nutty brother-in-law's nervous breakdown over some routine atrocity in today's newsfeed may be the same thing that we see as an opening. The stone that marks a new time. An opportunity to take what was never going to be given easily. As a changing of the guard. "Gentlemen," he said, "I don't need your organization. I've shined your shoes. I've moved your mountains and marked your cards. But Eden is burning. Either getting ready for elimination, or else your hearts must have the courage for the changing of the guards. Anyway, sometimes you feel the flow. Sometimes it's all rolling, like chariots to war. You've got one book going, and somehow it's all about the thing you need to do. And you pick up another book after dinner, and it's a completely different subject, from a different era, even. And it's like the marathon runner passed the baton. It just picks right up where the other one left off, where you left off reading. This can carry through for days and nights. A random radio station from halfway across the country or the globe. And just when you tune in, that's right, they're in on it too. Eventually, you have to put all that stuff down and do whatever it is. Do what it's telling you to do. The wheel goes round, and that's how these cycles reach completion. But it sure is fun. Beats picking cotton. Your mind is operating on a very high level in these situations, and you really cannot let anything get in the way. Sure, take a break and take a walk, goof off a little, but then get back on the wheel while you can. You can always clean the garage next week. I mean, who cares?
There's no question that there are strange things in the sky, but where they come from and what they're doing here is wide open. We know very little about them after 35 or 40 years of investigation. Our main problem, as I've stated in a number of books and articles, is that the will to believe is much stronger than the will to understand. People are very quick to accept a belief without any evidence, sometimes with no evidence at all. A lot of our major religions are based on that strange ability of the human mind to accept such beliefs. Now, with flying saucers, we have a similar situation. We have been accepting, at face value, a lot of the things that have been said. I'd say 98% of the literature on flying saucers is absolute garbage. I know this because I've had to read all of it over the years. When you try to track down some of these things, especially things that happened some years ago, you either end up at a blank wall, or you find that it was much different from what was reported in the flying saucer magazines of that time.
The words you heard there are by the late, great John A. Keel. John Keel. Whenever I meet somebody who is interested in weird stuff, lights in the sky, the fair folk, will-o'-the-wisp, whatever, I give him a copy of John Keel's book called Operation Trojan Horse. I've given out a bunch of these over the years, every time thinking, well, if they click with this stuff, we're gonna get thick as thieves. We'll have a mutual frame of reference. It's the kind of book that I believe is fairly crucial for looking at a lot of the strange situations that come up, the odd time that we are in, and how that fits into the great tapestry of time. I've mentioned John Keel more than a few times on this program, generally in passing, but occasionally in some kind of detail. And I thought I had the main gist of it all. But recently I decided to listen to his classic books, Operation Trojan Horse, and especially The Eighth Tower, which is a revelation, there's no better term for it. And to think that book, which presents a rational, mystical, moral, and honestly transcendent way to approach all of the synchronicities and oddities of our lives, of our culture, was made up of outtakes from the Mothman prophecies. I mean, what? But that's how it goes sometimes. The most interesting parts of the Bible went missing for about 17 centuries, and then all these missing texts showed up. At Nag Hammadi, Egypt, and in a complex of caves over the Dead Sea. At the same time, 1945 into 1947, more than 500 miles apart, both random discoveries, found not by archaeologists, but accidentally by peasants in Egypt and the Bedouin in the West Bank, in the chalky hills over the Dead Sea. There's some synchronicity. The directors of the Carl Jung Institute must have thought so too. They acquired a single codex, in fact, the first one on the European antiquities market. It was a birthday present to Carl Gustav Jung in 1951, and ever since it has been known as the Jung Codex. It includes five important Gnostic works, including A Prayer of the Apostle Paul. Your light, give me your mercy. My Redeemer, redeem me, for I am yours. The one who has come forth from you. You are my mind, bring me forth. You are my treasure house, open for me. You are my fullness, take me to you. You are my repose, give me the perfect thing that cannot be grasped. Grant what no angel eye has seen and no archon ear has heard, and what has not entered into the human heart, which came to be angelic and modeled after the image of the psychic God when it was formed in the beginning. Since I have faith and hope. And place upon me your beloved, elect, and blessed greatness, the firstborn, the first begotten, and the wonderful mystery of your house. The Prayer of the Apostle Paul. If you've got a copy of the third issue of Desert Oracle, well, you know the text on the back cover is a quote from John A. Keel. Christianity was not born with Christ, but with his death, and with the fanaticism of men like Saul Paul, who were reprogrammed by blinding lights on the desert. John Keel, The Eighth Tower, 1975. Listen, next week on this program, we are going to have a treat because the audiobook of The Eighth Tower, which you can get from your library or from the audiobook company, really did illuminate that text for me. I thought I knew it, and then to hear it is John Keel must have read it aloud to his friends over drinks in some midtown saloon in 1970s New York City, with his wry asides and his dry wit and his keen sense of storytelling and detail. Well, that audiobook is performed, narrated, I guess they call it, by an actor named Michael Hacker. Michael Hacker, who has narrated something like a half dozen John Keel books, and I've just been going through them all. And the one I'm on right now had me stopping on the trail, nodding my head, saying, "Yeah, that's it, that's right," so loud that the dog stopped and looked back at me. On the next program, we're going to have Michael Hacker, who seems to be channeling John Keel directly, so I'm very curious what effect this has had on Mr. Hacker, because this sort of stuff sort of rearranges your brain. Even if you're reading it for a job, a performance, it has to. Listen, Lucy over in accounting is telling me that I need to mention our Patreon. That's patreon.com/Desert Oracle, because that's how we do this show, with your support. So thanks to all of you who do it. We sure appreciate it. You can also subscribe to our periodical, Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized guide to the strange and unusual American desert. If you are a subscriber, friend, start watching that mailbox. Who knows how long mail takes to get around the United States, especially the always slow, rural, southwestern United States mail system. But it's at the printer and it's going out. As for this program, you can listen to us on KCDZ 107.7 FM in the high desert, Friday nights 10 to 11 p.m. And we always have plenty of strange soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Look them up on Bandcamp. Thank you for listening, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Our second episode today was produced by Ken Lane on September 25th of 2020, and it is titled The Eighth Tower. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Welcome to Joshua Tree, last exit before hell, especially in August. August is a time of month you never hear any visitors say, "You know, I really want to move to the desert." Because this is the time of year when tourists die when they come to Joshua Tree. This is the time of year when every year there's always a couple of people that never make it back. And then you see posters with their pictures all over town. And then eventually, a couple of weeks, a couple of months, sometimes a couple of years, the remains are found. But let's talk about something more cheerful. Something that sitting around a fire at a barbecue outside, times when people's guard is down a little bit, that's when people will start talking about the strange experiences that they have had in the high desert. Now, not strange experiences that are banal, not, you know, you lost your dog or somebody dumped some weird garbage in front of your cabin, that kind of thing. Instead, what we're talking about are wonders in the sky, cryptids, strange noises, the Spanish lady on old Route 66. You get a couple of beers in people, and they start to admit that maybe they've had experiences like that. Maybe they've seen something strange. If not them, maybe a good friend, an ex-wife, an old neighbor, an old grandpa who died in Phoenix years ago. Now, I collect these stories for my work. I try to draw them out of even the most proper people, because anybody who spent much time in the high desert eventually has some sort of experience with the anomalous. I'll give you a famous example. Elvis Presley was living in Palm Springs. He was doing a residency in Las Vegas. He took what is known as the back way to Vegas, up the grade 62 through Mojave Preserve and into town. Somewhere east of Joshua Tree, he sees something. His driver, his hairdresser, stops the car. He jumps out. Elvis Presley runs out into the desert and gets right under what he sees, which is some sort of light formation hovering in place over the desert. He gets under that thing and starts screaming to his hairdresser in the car. It's Joseph Stalin's face. Now, the hairdresser thought Elvis had once again just about lost it, but he could see that there was something out there. Apparently, from Elvis Presley's perspective, it looked like a big, terrifying face with heavy brows and that mustache. Graham Parsons, Keith Richards, all kinds of rock stars, artists, poets, minor movie characters, they've all come out to the desert and seen weird things. Graham Parsons and Keith Richards, the legend goes, used to drag a barber chair up on top of Cap Rock and sit up there and watch the UFOs or the passing planes descending into LAX, who knows. But sometimes people say, well, what about you? You collect all these stories. You ever see anything like this? Well, I've seen a few. I've seen a few that stick with me. And I've talked about the most impressive in terms of meeting a kind of late night desert radio standard of something very large and very strange and unexplained in the sky. That was up the 395 north of Ridgecrest going up to the Eastern Sierra. But right here in Joshua Tree, right here when it was just like this, oppressively hot, humid, people dropping dead like flies, I was coming back from Palm Springs, around 10 o'clock at night. I come up Highway 62 up the grade. Now, they were putting the sewer system in on Yucca Trail, if you know the shortcut to Joshua Tree, so I couldn't use that. I stayed on 62 to La Contenta. At La Contenta, I turned left on the Alta Loma. As I turn left, I see something hanging in the sky. Now, it's not a star or a planet that I'm aware of, but I figure I'll keep an eye on it. I get up to my place, park in the driveway, it's still there. I bring my stuff inside. I happen to have a house full of people at the time. So I got everybody outside. I'm like, come out and see this thing. What do you think? I got my phone, I turned on my astronomy app, you know, Star Walk. Held it up. No, it's not a planet, it's not a star. It was moving a little bit, but mostly kind of staying in place, kind of blue and white, yellow lights. About the size of Jupiter as it looks right now, hanging in the eastern sky. It was August 2017. So everybody comes out, oh, I don't know what that is. Let's get the bird binoculars, passing around the bird binoculars. I don't know. Whoa. It looks square. So we got a shape, square. I couldn't see a shape that was square. But some people with better eyes than I have through the binoculars, saw something like a square with blobs of light inside of it. So we all kind of agree that it is unidentified at the very least. At that moment, the thing accelerates from where it was and goes straight up into the sky, miles high, disappears in a little point of light. It was like a fireworks show, and everybody's going, oh. Well, like any responsible citizen, I went in that night, I looked on the social media and tried to see if anybody else saw anything like it, didn't see any reports. But the next day, listening to the radio, the local news, I hear that two young tourists have disappeared. And they disappeared, by the looks of it, directly under where this light was. From my house at the time, you could look out over Section 6, Section 5, into the park by the west entrance and over to an area called the Maze Loop Trail. Well, that's where this young couple, at least a couple of people, a guy and a girl, were. They rented an Airbnb. They never checked out. The host came and found that they'd left their stuff there. The park rangers found the car abandoned in the parking lot. And everybody went looking. You know what it's like in August, a monsoon season, when somebody goes missing. Helicopters, a search and rescue squad comes out. It was so hot that the search and rescue dogs had to be rescued. They had to helicopter them out. Months went by. And it wasn't until October when the search team made another round and found some clues and followed those clues. And there they found the remains of the couple. Who, it turns out, were not a couple. They had been together, age 20 and 21, I believe, from Orange County in Long Beach. But she was going to college, and he was a security guard, and she put him in the friend zone. And he brought her out to Joshua Tree for her birthday. Just friends. Well, the way they found them was her remains were behind a tree in a little canyon. His remains were on top of her. She had a bullet in her head. He had a bullet in his head. He brought a loaded handgun on a day hike. Killed them both. I don't know what the correlation is between the weird light in the sky right over that point where they were found on the night they disappeared. But I do know that Americans especially see anything in the sky, and they've all seen too many Star Trek episodes or something, because they think space aliens. But long before we made up that idea, wonders in the sky were signs. They pointed things out to us. And if we knew how to read them, if we knew how to make sense of them, then maybe we wanted to look for 3 months for those people. Maybe we would have sent somebody right over. Maybe we would have like an auger who works for the National Park Service. And we got a light over there. Go check and see if there's any missing people. So next time you're out under a desert night sky, look up there and see what you can find. And if you have something that seems to be pointing to a location, maybe go take a look.
Welcome to Desert Oracle Radio. I'm your host, Ken Lane, and as I mentioned on last week's program, I've been listening to these audiobooks of the classic UFO paranormal books by John A. Keel. His best-known book being The Mothman Prophecies, and the ones I mentioned last week, Operation Trojan Horse and The Eighth Tower, which is actually made of cast-offs from The Mothman Prophecies. And these books offer a very interesting approach to the whole UFO paraphysical issue. It's not like your ancient aliens on TV where they're trying to throw everything into some wild theory about aliens in space helmets visiting Moses or whatever. But they're illuminating. And in fact, Keel talks a lot about illumination as both a religious and philosophical goal that is worth working for. The reader, the narrator, the performer on these books, and a new one I've since started, is Michael Hacker, actor and audiobook narrator. And we got him on the phone from Minnesota. Michael Hacker, welcome to Desert Oracle Radio.
Thank you, Ken. Nice to be here.
You were mentioning before we went on the air here that when you're doing audiobooks, you have a specific subject you like to stay within. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, what attracted me to audiobooks originally was it was an outlet for my acting, but I have since moved into an area that really fascinates me, and that is the paranormal nonfiction. There are other genres of paranormal in audiobooks, but paranormal nonfiction, when I started, was really underrepresented, and I wanted to change that. You know, I've always had an interest in the paranormal. I grew up in Iowa, around the corner from Brad Steiger, who is another paranormal researcher. John Keel mentions him several times in his books. And I just always was fascinated by it. I was probably the only high school student in the state of Iowa reading Rosicrucian tracts back in the day. So it goes way back.
That's kind of a marker for the rest of your life, isn't it?
Exactly. I was interested in developing ESP.
Oh!
But I was fascinated by people like Uri Geller and the great psychic that Brad Steiger was huge friends with. And I'm going to space on her name. She's definitely gone from the world at this point, but I remember talking to Brad's wife about the tarot, and she said, well, most tarot readers are psychic, and I'd never heard anything like that before. I thought that was unique, that people believed it. And so it really made me think again about the paranormal and what's at its core. And John Keel really gets to that bullseye in his writing.
Now, John Keel, before his work with UFOs and monsters, which he was happy to bridge the gap between, and saying there was no gap between them, he started off as a amateur stage magician, and also thought that he was developing psychic powers in his youth.
Right. He, in the book you're currently reading, Flying Saucer, he gives his personal recollection on his being struck by cosmic consciousness. And it's an interesting moment in his development. It really changed his life. And he felt for the better, because he gained a consciousness that expanded beyond his own experience and touched on things that were cosmic, larger than him. And that's something that I think a lot of people have had in the past. He's really interested in talking to his witnesses about that experience that they've had. And he cites where people who have had this experience have had it in direct relationship to extraterrestrial or ultra-terrestrial visitation, sighting UFOs, being in the presence of what he calls big hairy monsters, BHM, and how they have changed as individuals, and their philosophies have changed. A lot of them will abandon their jobs and families and maybe even start alternate religious groups or cults based on their experience.
He had kind of a scale of impact where some people seem to lose it completely and not be able to integrate their experience with their daily life. And then there was the other side, and these were people who often found themselves in creative fields, although not necessarily. It might be in environmental nonprofits or in clergy or whatever it may be, but were able to integrate this wider view that comes from this illumination experience into their daily lives and not wreck everything.
Right. Well, I think it's rather a sense of communication on that level, where they are listening, but they are also giving. They are giving back. They are motivated on a mission, so to speak, to help others, to save the planet, to make the world a better place. And yet it's a double-edged sword, as John Keel mentions. People can become destroyed by it. And he does warn that it's dangerous. And so do other books that I've read about the experience.
A few weeks ago on this show, we were talking about the experience that 62 school children in Rua, Zimbabwe had in 1994 at the Ariel School.
And I know it well.
Yeah, a fantastic event. And John Mack, the Harvard head of the psychiatry school. Oops. What happened here?
I'm on with you.
Okay. Sorry, I had a ghost track suddenly come up in my ears.
Well, we're talking about UFOs and paranormal. That's bound to happen.
It's bound to happen. We're going to get the clicks. We're going to get the weird laughter, the mechanical laughter.
And if we start hearing a series of numbers, then we're in big trouble.
Yes.
Then we can expect a visit from the Men in Black.
I'm always on the lookout for them. The black sedan and the men in the strangely new clothing and that whole scene.
The sing-song voice.
The voice, yeah. You're a Philip K. Dick reader, and you had brought up Valis, the vast artificial living intelligence system that plays a role in especially the famous Valis trilogy, but it seems to have a part in a lot of Philip K. Dick books. The Keel version of this is what he calls the super spectrum. Having kind of gotten inside of Keel's head and reading these books, what do you make of the super spectrum, and how do you describe it? And is it something that you consider that fits into your worldview, or...
Well, it does. My understanding from reading Keel's work is that his concept of the superspectrum is slightly different than what he calls the eighth tower. His description of the eighth tower is very similar to Valis. It's the same thing. Both of them were clued into a vast invisible intelligence that was affecting human life on this planet. The super spectrum is where it kind of exists. It is beyond ultraviolet, and he definitely considers energy to be part of the mystery, and that paraphysical entities descend from the super spectrum through the spectrum of light to the point where we can see them. Certain people have innate in their genes, that their biology, the ability to see farther into the light spectrum than others. And they are the people who normally can see these paraphysical apparitions.
So here we have something that's not just extra sensory perception, but it's multiple channels of extra sensory perception, because you've got
exactly
psychic element, and then a visual perception. And he uses the word that I've seen some other people like Jacques Vallée use, which is percipient.
Yes, the witness, the individual who can perceive these things. Not everyone can see them, he says. In fact, I have a personal anecdotal story from one of my coworkers at Mayo Clinic who said that she was with a family, and one of the members of the family, who was a young girl, adolescent girl, had poltergeist experiences. When they were together, they were out enjoying a nice evening, and they all saw UFOs. And that was the only time she ever saw a UFO. I think Keel would say that it was the proximity to that girl that allowed them to see it. That somehow she projected her ability to see into the super spectrum onto other people in her presence.
This is fascinating, and it's the mm-hmm. the kind of thing that if you don't know people who have had this experience, or if it hasn't been something that's happened in your own life, it mm-hmm. can sound a little nutty, because we don't really have the terms to describe a kind of borrowed psychic ability.
Right. It's one of those things that are mysterious and yet extremely plausible, in my view. This can be effectively granted to other people, or one of the terms that Keel uses is hallucinosis, the sense of contagious perception.
That's an incredible term.
Yeah.
Hallucinosis.
Yeah.
I started incorporating some of John Keel's stuff into our magazine, Desert Oracle, which is a magazine about desert folklore and history and the mm-hmm. natural environment, the flora and fauna, and also the monsters. Yeah. We have our Yucca Man. And We got our big... He's not... Well, whether he's big and hairy or not, he is... always described as he, although families have been seen under Edwards Air Force Base over in the western Mojave.
Oh, yeah. Are they described as green men by any chance?
No, these are the dark and smelly big ones.
All right. Well, they stink.
Yeah.
They do stink.
They have
Keel talks about that they stink of sulfur sometimes.
Which, you know, makes perfect sense if... Like me, you grew up in a, you know, going to a Baptist church. They told you what the devil was going to smell like.
Indeed. Indeed. So it all might be part of the same myth pool, the same folklore. Keel talks about that in his famous letter when he was resigning from UFO research back in the 70s. And he said, read the Bible. It's all there. I'm not suggesting that I'm a religious person, a religious nut, but I think that some of the folklore, some of the myths are shared. And Keel himself talks about frame of reference, how people perceive these paraphysical entities and paraphysical apparitions through their frame of reference. So
right.
that in the 19th century, you saw these flying airships out of Jules Verne. Before that, you saw fairies and leprechauns, and before that, you saw demons and devils, and before that, going back to the Greeks, they considered daemons, or D-E-A-M-O-Ns, the Kakodaimon and the Agathodaimon, which today is still in popular culture. When you see the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other, that's what the Greeks were talking about.
Right, so, and then these things ended up becoming part of supposedly Christian culture, because Christian culture subsumed classical mm-hmm. culture, and it all goes in this circle. And
I think there's a unified whole to it, I really do. Human experience is shared, and again, it's the frame of reference. So much of early Christian belief was based on that sense of logic, and they famously were trying to count the number of angels on the head of a pin.
Right. And that kind of thing. And the levels of hell and all of that.
Uh-huh. Exactly. It all had to be structured.
And there had to be a theology that had 800 pages mm-hmm. written about it. It
right.
could not just right. be you're walking in the wilderness and you encounter some sort mm-hmm. of entity of light and you right. are enriched by it.
That was suspect. Yeah. And based on on Western culture, everything is rational.
From Amboy to Zyzix and across the Great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to our guest, Michael Hacker. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the tunes. And thanks to you for listening. And good night from the Voice of the Desert.
My thanks to Ken Lane for producing the episodes we heard today. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And I'll be back next week with more. Right here on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Stay well. See you then. Bye-bye.